Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Telecommunications and Electronic Media Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, March 5th, 2018, during a live teleform conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members.
Welcome to the Practice Group's teleform conference call, as today we discuss net neutrality and the Congressional Review Act. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups here at the Federal Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future and will likely be transcribed. We're very pleased to welcome two return guests to Teleforum today, the Honorable John Neuer. He's the president and founder of JKC Consulting, LLC, and a senior partner at the Fairfax Media Partners. He'll be joined by Paul Larkin. He's a senior legal research fellow at the Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation here in Washington, D.C. We're going to get opening remarks from each of some 10 to 15 minutes, but as always, we'll be looking to the audience for questions, so please have those in mind for when we get to that portion of the program. Let me apologize for our slightly delayed start, but we'll have plenty of time for discussion. With that, John Neuer, the floor is yours.
Thanks very much. Thanks to the Federal Society for putting this on, and thanks for everyone who has dialed in their expressions of interest on this topic. I thought I would go back and try and lay the regulatory history of how we've gotten to where we are on net neutrality. Net neutrality as an economic market concept around broadband networks has lots of different beginning points that one could point to, either in the scholarship literature, in discussions over different mergers. I look back at a lot of these issues being raised in the AOL Time Warner merger, where it was the first real concept of the potential anti-competitive possibilities around the combination of what they at the time called content and conduit, and that if a single entity controlled both the delivery mechanism and popular content, that they would have incentives and means to act in an anti-competitive way. But I think I'll start from a regulatory standpoint. As I said, these concepts were in the literature and in the public domain, but they really got their first life as a regulatory concept in 2004, when then FCC Chairman Powell articulated at the time what he called the four internet freedoms, which he laid out as consumers should have access to the lawful content of their choice. They should have freedom to use whatever apps they desired, that they were free to attach whatever devices to the broadband network that fit within the terms of service of their broadband provider, and that there would be transparency on the part of the broadband provider on their terms of service and the limitations that there might be. So these were non-binding, and they were essentially a statement of objectives that the FCC wanted to put in place. They were really never tested until 2008, at which point the FCC was made aware of complaints that Comcast at the time was slowing down BitTorrent and other peer-to-peer providers. Comcast argued that it was simply network management practices to balance out the network when individual users were consuming huge portions of the overall network capacity. The more suspicious and the opponents of it saw it as a clear indication of the dangers of this combination of content and conduit, that Comcast, with being in the business of selling video content, viewed BitTorrent and peer-to-peer delivering of movies back and across the network as competitive, and they were interfering with that delivery. So the FCC ordered Comcast to stop interfering with peer-to-peer networks. Comcast appealed that order, and the court overturned the FCC and said that they did not have a statutory basis upon which they could they could enforce that order against Comcast. So with that being overturned later in 2010, under Chairman Jenikowski, they adopted a more narrowly tailored standard for no unreasonable discrimination against unaffiliated content, and it explicitly excluded wireless networks because the belief was that the wireless networks were both more competitive and required different sorts of network management practices given the limits on their capacity. That case itself was appealed, and again it was overturned in 2014. In the 2014 case, however, the court again said that the FCC did not have authority, statutory authority, but it gave the FCC a window of opportunity in that the court made it clear that the reason the FCC did not have authority to regulate in this space is because broadband services had been identified as information services and therefore subject to a light touch regulatory framework as articulated in the 1996 Act. That gave the FCC and gave opponents of net neutrality landed on the legal mechanism of saying, well, if you reclassify broadband services as communication services, then they can be regulated under Title II, and that is ultimately what the FCC decided to do in 2015. So, and that is the decision that the PI administration or the PI FCC has just overturned, bringing us to the this process that is currently underway on Capitol Hill of the Congressional Review Act and an attempt to use to have the Congress overturn the PI decision. The upshot of all of this, however, irrespective of one's views on the technical merits of net neutrality, has been considerably more than a decade of regulatory uncertainty and a whipsawing back and forth that has made it very difficult for investors anywhere in the ecosystem to have certainty, whether it's on the carrier, from the carrier perspective, whether it is on the application layer. There remains macro uncertainty given how the net neutrality has had a history in the courts of uncertainty, and even to the extent that it is left in the direct purview of the FCC, it's subject to the changing of administration and new chairman. So I'm going to turn it over to Paul to talk a little bit about the Congressional Review Act and that process that is underway, but I think we can then collectively speak a little bit more about what the macro environment is like and how to bring certainty to this segment of the economy around all issues of not just net neutrality, but of investment and business plans. So, Paul, if you want to talk a little bit about the CRA.
My pleasure. Historically, once a rulemaking had been completed, the next step was essentially litigation if someone thought that the rule was arbitrary and capricious or that it lacked substantial evidence or there was some other defect in the notice and comment process. But in 1996, Congress added an additional type of review, if you will. The Congressional Review Act is a statute that provides for expedited review by each House of Congress and presentation to the President if a bill is passed by each House of Congress on a particular rule that an agency has adopted. Now, if you read the text of it, it's quite clear that it was designed to make sure that Congress could overturn any agency rule, and the term rule is a very broadly written term that would certainly include the order that the FCC adopted here. In order to really understand how this Congressional Review Act works, however, it's helpful to keep in mind an old aphorism of Oliver Wendell Holmes. He once said, "A page of history is worth a volume of logic," and that certainly applies here. Because for a long period, beginning in the New Deal era, Congress decided that the best way to rein in agency rulemaking was not simply to rely on the traditional methods of jawboning or restricting the use of appropriations or holding up appointments and the like. For a very long time, Congress added to hundreds of different statutes a provision called the legislative veto provision that allowed either or both houses of Congress to nullify an agency rule if the majority in either house or both decided it didn't like it, or that it was unconstitutional, or that it was unwise for some other reason. This went along for quite some time. The executive branch always thought this was an intrusion into the president's authority, even though Congress certainly thought that this was a rather reasonable limitation on what agencies were allowed to do. After all, there's no requirement that agencies be allowed to exist or even to adopt any legislative rules. Nonetheless, for a long time, it simply was an academic discussion. In 1983, however, the Supreme Court, in a case called INS versus Chadha, held that the legislative veto was unconstitutional because it violated the Article I procedures by which Congress can make law. The problem was it was a bicameral requirement, the Supreme Court said, and it also involved presentment to the president for his signature or, if he vetoed it, an override. The legislative veto violated that because it allowed, in some cases, a majority in either house of Congress to nullify what an agency had lawfully adopted as law pursuant to whatever delegated authority the agency had. Congress wanted to be able to rein in agencies, however, and so it decided that what it needed to do, and perhaps what it could only do, was to come up with something that was as close to a legislative veto as possible, but that satisfied the bicameralism and presentment requirements in Article I. The Congressional Review Act was that answer. Under the Act, every time an agency adopts a rule, it's supposed to publish it not only in the Federal Register, but submit it to Congress. It then goes to the relevant committee, where it will work its way up to the floor so that there can be a debate for a limited amount of time, and then a vote on the rule in each chamber. If either chamber fails to pass a resolution of disapproval, that is essentially a bill that would disapprove the agency rule, then the rule stands. If, however, both chambers pass it, it then gets sent to the president like any other piece of legislation, and the president can veto it. As a practical matter, this didn't happen very frequently. In fact, until 2017, it happened only once in the entire 20-plus year history of the statute. Nonetheless, last year, Congress made frequent use of the Congressional Review Act, nullifying 15 different rules, most of which had been adopted during the final days of the Obama administration. So what happens now is this. People who are opposed to what the FCC did, that is people in Congress, such as Senator Markey, can bring a bill up for a vote on whether or not to hold invalid the agency order, in this case the Internet regulatory order. If a majority passes it in the Senate and a majority passes it in the House, then it goes to the president, where it'll be up to the president to decide whether to veto or sign the bill that is a disapproval resolution. If it were to become law, then what would happen is that would have this effect. It would mean that the FCC could not reissue a substantially similar rule unless and until Congress had passed new authorizing legislation. Now, the meaning of what is substantially similar has never been actually litigated in court, and there are at least two different ways of looking at it. One is essentially similar to selecting paint. It's essentially a color matching test. That is, how different is the new rule from the old rule? There are different ways of measuring the difference. For example, did the old rule use a top-down approach with penalties, and does the new rule instead allow for a more decentralized disposition of a matter with incentives rather than penalties? That might be one way Congress could try to, an agency could try to come up with something that is substantially different. But it's unclear. Different people have offered different interpretations of that term, and as yet no court has really, certainly at the circuit court or Supreme Court level, adopted one or the other. Another approach is just to look at it from essentially what Congress was probably trying to do, is probably trying to prevent an agency from engaging in shenanigans by essentially readopting the same rule, just to put Congress in a position of having to nullify it over and over and over again until finally Congress got tired of it. If so, then you take a look at the new rule and try to figure out, is this an attempt to circumvent what Congress had done? If it is not, then it is not, substantially similar. Problem with that approach, however, is that it focuses more on the intent of the agency than on the rule, and the statute says the rule can't be readopted unless there is intervening legislation or the rule is substantially different. So that's where we have it now. Senator Markey has indicated that he wants to bring this up, probably for a vote in the Senate and then the House, hopefully in the position of getting both of them to pass it. But even if it doesn't wind up getting passed by this, either or both of the chambers, and if it doesn't wind up getting signed by the president into law, we still have the traditional sort of vehicle that will come into play, that is litigation. And my colleague is far more skilled at interpreting that part of this whole problem than I am. So I'm going to turn it back to him and to Dean.
Very good. Let's open the floor to questions. This is Dean, by the way. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for either of our guests, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button. Our lines are wide open. Before we turn to the audience, let me turn back to John Noor and see if he has further remarks or comments or something to add to what he said earlier in response, perhaps, to what Paul Larkins just said. John?
Sure. The impact of the CRA in the ways that that Paul is describing it are really twofold. It is the legal mechanism in the off chance, were it to be successful, that the FCC could not pass a substantially similar rule. And so the proponents of this solution see it not just as a way to restore the Title II framework that was adopted by the Obama administration, but it would become essentially impossible for the FCC to bring it back again without there being intervening legislation in between. And I think that is sort of the key dynamic of what's going on now with the CRA. So the general underlying principles of net neutrality, and I've talked about some of the internet freedoms that Powell had adopted and some of the things that Chairman Jenikowski tried to articulate. But basically, the general concepts are that a network operator cannot act in an anti-competitive fashion to interfere with the delivery of content and services across its network to the end user consumer. And that's typically been captured with three general principles. No blocking, which is precisely what it sounds like. A internet service provider cannot block consumers from access to legal content. No throttling, which is a variation thereof, that you can't interfere with the delivery in such a way as to cause a competitive disadvantage to the content that is being interfered with. And the third concept being what is referred to as no paid prioritization or no fast lanes and no slow lanes. And this is sort of a variation of the throttling concept, but it tends to have much more far-reaching implications. So at its most benign, the sense is that, you know, that carriers don't get in the business of having tiered access so that they offer a substandard baseline service, but a consumer-grade service, the only available consumer-grade service, is one that the carrier gets to charge the content provider more for. So the carrier, to use a simple example, could go to a content provider like Hulu or Netflix and say, sure, our baseline service for consumers is 500 kilobits per second, and it'll take you 4 hours or 4 days to download a movie, but we can provide you something else which will allow you to get your content directly to the consumer in exchange for rents paid to us, the carrier. The problem with that easy articulation is that at its most fundamental, a concept of no pay prioritization winds up with a one-size-fits-all service offering that may not be in consumers' interests in a world where specialized services require specialized quality of service. So, for example, the things like telemedicine and autonomous vehicles and other sort of Internet of Things applications where a degree of bit error rate or latency, which would be immaterial in the delivery of a high definition movie, might be completely incompatible with a high-end service. So there should be a reasonable consensus on a bipartisan basis that the broad strokes of net neutrality could be captured in legislation. There would be some debate and detail over paid prioritization, but the industry does not object to bright line rules that say no blocking, no throttling. There is broad consensus across party lines on those concepts. Like I said, there is some disagreement or concern for careful drafting if we were to address issues of paid prioritization. But there is a fairly broad consensus. The problem is a breakdown in the politics of it. And I think the proponents of the Congressional Review Act believe that Title II is sort of a no-compromise solution for net neutrality, and that to give up on Title II would be somehow offensive to their political base. And so I believe they have an incentive to fight the Congressional Review Act to the end of its statutory availability, and Paul can correct me on any details on the time limits on those sorts of things. And at the same time, the very existence of the Congressional Review Act argument creates a disincentive for the majority on the Hill, particularly in the Senate, to propose compromise bipartisan legislation. So while there is a bill in the House sponsored by Congressman Blackburn, the Open Internet Preservation Act, which essentially captures no blocking, no throttling, it has features to preempt state laws, so we don't have a patchwork of 50 net neutrality frameworks. It skips over paid prioritization. But like I said, I think there would be some discussion around limiting anti-competitive action around prioritization, but allows for innovation and investment and a diversity of services for a diversity of needs. But it's that dynamic of having, so long as the CRA process is out there, it's going to be used as a cudgel in the midterm elections, and I think the CRA proponents are very transparent that they view this as a political exercise and that they think it's better to have the issue than the solution. But I think once that runs its course, there will be an incentive to bring parties together to bring some certainty to the net neutrality issue. Paul, do you have any comments on that, or do we have any questions from the audience?
We do have, Paul, this is Dean. We do have one audience question, but I'm going to give you a chance to extend your remarks if you're
well. No, I'm glad to respond. I mean, I don't really disagree with anything that John said, but let's give the listener a chance to ask a question. So it's fine by me. I'm glad to listen.
Very good. Once again, if you have a question, if you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take our first call of the day.
Hi, this is Professor Daniel Lyons at Boston College Law School. A question about the CRA procedure. Do you have any sense of what flexibility the Senate leadership might have to delay a vote on Markey's CRA resolution? I remember when we were focused on the privacy CRA last year, there was some concern that although it was obvious it had the votes, it wasn't clear that there would be enough time on the legislative calendar before the 60 days ran out. Is there a procedural mechanism that the leadership may be able to use here?
Well, I think the statute contemplates that there will be a vote in the Senate. I mean, subsection 801B3, for example, says the following, quote, "In the Senate, immediately following the conclusion of the debate on a joint resolution described elsewhere in the statute, and a single quorum call at the conclusion of the debate, if requested in accordance with the rules of the Senate," and here's the relevant part, "the vote on final passage of the joint resolution shall occur," unquote. So it seems to me the statute contemplates that there will be a vote in the Senate. And if that means the Senate has to stay a little late in order to make sure there's a vote, well, that means they have to stay a little late to make sure there's a vote. And the statute seems to set out a procedure that is designed to make sure that the Senate votes on this. And so I don't think that if there was an effort by the majority leader of either party, whenever this arose, to not have a vote, that it would work. It seems to me the statute speaks right to the issue.
Very good. We do have another question. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. For now, let's move to our second caller.
Hi, this is Kurt Levy with the Committee for Justice. I guess we're all assuming that the CRA challenge won't work, at that point there'll be some sort of compromise legislation. What can you make any predictions about what you think the compromise legislation will look like and whether it will pass?
John, I think that's in your ballpark.
Sure. So what has been most troublesome about Title II and the way that Title II was particularly adopted under the Wheeler Commission was that it really, in effect, there's two important parts that I think are crying out for remedy. One was the Wheeler decision, in addition to reclassifying under Title II, it found a new authority that they articulated as the general conduct rule, which was essentially, as described by Chairman Wheeler, a catch-all that made the FCC the quote-unquote ref on the field who could blow a whistle on basically any course of conduct that they found objectionable. And so what that really achieved was it put the FCC in the very center of the Internet for all questions of innovation and new product service offerings. So rather than consumers making choices based on technology and price and features and competitors innovating around price and functionality and innovation, the FCC was the ultimate arbiter of market access rather than the market being the ultimate arbiter of commercial success. So eliminating that and making it clear and getting back to the concept enshrined in the 1996 Act, which is that we should have a policy objective of abundance in these networks, and the best way to get that would be to subject them to the lightest possible regulatory framework. And I think that was very successful up until 2015, where we had over $1 trillion in investment, et cetera. So I think an ultimate statutory remedy is going to, I think, return to that core concept of these markets don't require a lot of ex-ante regulation. Another artifact of Title II, however, which is less commented on, but I also think important, is that it took the authority from the FTC with regards to privacy and enshrined it with the FCC. And I think there is a, I'm not sure how broad the consensus is, but there's certainly a desire to make sure that the, to return that authority to the FTC and have issues of anti-competitive behavior by market participants in this space handled through law enforcement at the FTC. So I think that ultimately we will have legislation. I think it will pass. I think its general framework will be clarity on privacy, very bright lines on throttling and blocking, and a more nuanced view on paid prioritization that limits the carriers from seeking rents in anti-competitive ways, but also leaves space for product differentiation and innovation. I think, in particular, one hears there's a lot of discussion in the market around the wireless part of this industry and their deployment of fifth-generation technology and fifth-generation networks. Those fifth-generation networks, sort of by definition, are a specialized tier of service that will be more reliable, faster, less latency, less error than their 4G service counterparts. So unlike the evolution of the wireless network where we went from analog wireless phones, as called that first generation, to digital, which is the second generation, and the CDMA and the long-term evolution is the fourth generation, each one of those successive deployments replaced the one before. 5G is likely to exist alongside of 4G as a differentiated product service offering, and I don't know how that is compatible with a bright line prohibition on paid prioritization. So I think that is the one place where you're going to see some discussion and nuance, but the general issues of blocking, throttling, giving consumers access to legal content is really non-controversial at this point.
Okay, so to make sure I understand you, you think we will have a statute that covers privacy, throttling, blocking, to some extent paid prioritization, and that the FCC will be running the show, except on privacy, but will be the statute will specify that it can't be done under Title II / has to have a lighter touch.
Right. I think it will ultimately cure the defect that the courts kept on, the reason the courts would continually overturn the FCC, and the reason the carriers, even though the carriers weren't concerned about the prohibitions that the FCC was trying to articulate in the case against Comcast and the Verizon lawsuit of the Jenikowski order, it was more that the FCC was articulating an authority that the carriers did not believe they had, and if it wasn't challenged, it would leave the FCC with sort of an unbounded authority to regulate in whatever manner they saw fit. So it's getting back to this general concept or policy objective that new broadband networks not be regulated as natural monopolies, the way that that communication services are regulated, which was an artifact of the monopoly network.
Thank you.
Hey, Kurt, this is Paul Larkin. Let me try to answer your question in a slightly different way. I think the debate has been basically very well laid out by my colleague, but I would say essentially the concern is if you allow different charges to be made, then there'll be people that'll be driving a Mercedes, and that'll mean the people who are driving VWs don't have the same nice car. So the net neutrality rule that the Obama administration adopted forced everybody to drive a VW to avoid any of the risk that the people who couldn't afford the Mercedes wouldn't be able to buy one. So now what they'll do is they'll have different types of cars that can be driven. The people that build the Mercedes are certainly not going to be able to keep the VWs off the road. That's the blocking and weakening or whatever.
Right.
But you'll have different types of vehicles that can be driven. You'll have different types of service. And the question is, are we going to see legislation that tries to close the gap between the Mercedes and the VWs, or to legislation that will somehow subsidize the people that can only afford VWs, or that will make it look like a VW really is a Mercedes? That's, you know, the way the political process works.
Well, what do you predict in that regard? I mean, will it be, you know, let's assume we don't have complete ban on paid prioritization. Will it be something very light, or will it be more of, you're describing something, you know, more along the lines of a social, for lack of a better word, I'm just going to say a socialism type approach?
You know, in terms of making a political prediction, I don't have any idea. I don't pay much attention to politics. I care more about the policies involved. So other people who are more interest in the politics and play more attention to that would be in a much better position than I am to make that call.
Fair enough.
Once again, our lines are wide open. If you have a question, now's the time to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. While we wait to see if somebody else rings in, I'll ask maybe a Congressional Review Act question, if you want to say more about this, Paul or John. And that's whether the FCC, when it finally went forward on net neutrality, did it notify Congress, as we've heard that some agencies failed to in the past before the Congressional Review Act became a big issue in recent months. And I wonder if you could say more about the legislative prospects and the prohibition on an agency regulating again, passing the same regulation again, or a substantially similar regulation under the Congressional Review Act, if that's used successfully, and what that looks like with or without subsequent legislation.
Sure. Let me go to that first, and then John, of course, can answer. Whether or not the FCC notified Congress in compliance with the Congressional Review Act is simply a pure factual question. The agency should know the answer to that, as well as the parliamentarian or secretary of the respective chambers. The irony is, if the agency did not notify Congress back when it came out with the order that was just repealed, then that order was not in effect, which means that the only order that would have been in effect is the one that came out now, or whatever predecessor order there was dealing with this issue, which I imagine did not impose a net neutrality requirement. So if Congress didn't receive the FCC's order adopting the net neutrality rules in the Obama administration, then that order is not yet in effect, and so it's as if it has not been adopted at all. As to what will happen if Congress were to nullify this particular order that's now out there, again, that will turn on what, if anything, there was in place before. If there was no submission of the old rule to Congress, then even if Congress and the president nullified this one, that would mean it would go back to whatever pre-Obama rule was in place. If the FCC did notify Congress of this, the Obama rule, then the Obama rule is valid until this one is upheld or overturned. So I don't know what the factual answer is to the question you mentioned, and I'm sure somebody right now is probably feverishly trying to answer it, because there's a whole lot at stake on that. But my guess is we'll find that out in the near future.
Good. John Noor, anything on this point?
Not on the particular mechanisms, but like I said, back to, I guess it was Kurt, the earlier questioner, on the politics of it and the likelihood of there being a legislative solution. I think this is going to have to run its course one way or another. My expectation is that whether they get the votes in the Senate, they're unlikely to get the votes in the House, and beyond that, they're exceedingly unlikely to have the president sign it. So this is a bit of a theatrical exercise as much as it is a legal exercise, but I also think it is going to be necessary for as a political matter before the parties can come back to the table and say, okay, it is time for us to have a – final answer to this question, the uncertainty and the changing of the regulatory regime every 6 to 18 months for the past 15 years is no way to do business. And I think there's a growing consensus among, certainly among the carriers, that they would not be in opposition to net neutrality legislation. They would in fact be supporters of it. And then I think there's also likely to be a growing desire to find legislative solutions to some of the issues that are not focused on carriers so much, but are focused on the application layer and the tech community, where I think there are raising concerns about the competitive practices of big tech, and they are explicitly not included in Title II. So to the extent there is a desire to have a comprehensive approach for correcting anti-competitive or guarding against anti-competitive behavior in the broadband space, you may have a broader consensus of market participants who want to see it solved once and for all.
Very good. Once again, we've got about 15 minutes left. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got just one question pending, so let's take another call.
Hi, Chris Garvey from New York, a libertarian perennial candidate. There are a couple of things which have been neglected in the public relations about this thing, and the only place I ever see them is on these Federalist Society teleforums. One is that the free market, or as free as the market was, even under the duopolies and monopolies that the internet service providers were in most of the country, net neutrality had always been practiced before the Obama regulations. Secondly, that the Obama regulations were simply an end run around the fact that they had no authority, and so they simply applied 3,000 pages of regulations. And Obama's administration said, well, if you want to be an internet provider, all you have to do is tell us what you think you're going to do, and we'll give you a non-binding pass on this, except if we change our mind, we can shut you down, which was a really discouraging thing to entry into the system. Google and Facebook are monopolies at this point. They're also state-sponsored monopolies, and I think there's a pretty good argument that the First Amendment applies to these under the Civil Rights Act, which says that if you are a corporation that was funded by the U.S. government, the Civil Rights Act applies to you, and if you try to deny people their First Amendment rights and their rights to campaign and their rights to mention candidates, you're violating the Civil Rights Act. So I'll throw that out to you to see if you have any thoughts on those points.
So this is Neuer. Aside from the civil rights issue, I do think you raise a point about the market-based solutions to the fears of net neutrality. And the proponents of net neutrality hinge most of their arguments on defining scarcity. And the way they do that is they continue to increase the speeds upon which they will hang a definition of broadband services. And therefore, with the higher speeds, you exclude many, many market participants who provide wholesome counter-incentives to the kind of misbehavior that lies at the heart of net neutrality. So in a world with one broadband provider, or in a marketplace with one broadband provider, that provider would in fact have strong market-based incentives to discriminate in favor of their own affiliated content and services. But in a marketplace where consumers have an ability to choose, then discriminating against what content and services consumers can acquire becomes a negative market differentiator, right? Consumers will choose, will always choose carriers and providers that don't limit their ability to access content and services over those that do. In that regard, the wireless industry is increasingly providing direct one-to-one competition with fixed services, but even to the extent that they're not providing a one-to-one service replacement, they're providing a very strong market-based disincentive to anti-competitive or anti-consumer behavior. So if I have a wireline provider that is providing, giving me, you know, 100 megabits per second, I can't get that from my wireless provider. But if that that fixed provider that may be providing me 100 megabits per second starts to interfere with the content and services that I can access over their network, I am going to drop them in favor of what may be a service with less ultimate speed and throughput capacity, but that offers me a richer experience. So carriers compete on all sorts of levels at this point. They compete on mobility, on speed, on price. So in a competitive marketplace, most of the fears of net neutrality start to go away anyhow. But if instead what we're left with is something like a general conduct rule, like you articulated, while the carriers don't have any incentive to act in anti-competitive or anti-consumer ways, the regulatory environment just throws up a huge barrier to innovation because nobody knows what they're allowed to do. So I think you articulated the backdrop well, and I think that is also something that is that dynamic. And a, you know, we started talking about net neutrality 15 years ago, where we didn't have anything like the abundance of networks that we have now. And every year that has gone by, the incentives for carriers to act in ways that would be problematic becomes less and less.
I think one thing that that is going on, if you look at what Google and Facebook are doing right now with the Alex Jones network, is they are banning and removing YouTube channels, and YouTube, of course, is owned by Google, from banning anyone who has the right wing, the conservative, the libertarian view. They're being banned from these sites by specific ad hoc bans. An awful lot of them are being taken down right now, which I think is both a antitrust and a First Amendment problem. But we'll see what happens with that, I guess.
Okay. Well, with that, let me give each of our experts a chance to wrap up, express a final thought. Let's go in the order in which we started. John Neuer, final thought.
Net neutrality is a policy consideration that has, or a policy objective that has gone through, you know, more than a decade of regulation, litigation, re-regulation, with never a final answer in legislation, and that I think the industry deserves, and the industry and consumers would greatly benefit from certainty in this space. And hopefully once this CRA process has run its course, you know, we can get that certainty so that this is not something that is subject to revisiting every 4 to 8 years with a new FCC.
Final thought from Paul Arkin.
Even ping pong games have to come to an end sometime. I don't think it's likely that this game will come to an end with an invalidation of the most recent FCC order under the Congressional Review Act. But hopefully it will if the whole Congress takes this issue up. I agree with my colleague that this is the sort of matter that Congress should and must address, and it's probably better addressed in the context of full legislation than in the context of the Congressional Review Act. In any event, it's unlikely that even if both houses of Congress passed such an order to nullify the FCC rule that the president would sign it. So that just forces the Congress to address this. Maybe it won't address it in 18, maybe it won't address it in 19, but eventually it's going to have to address it.
Well, this is Dean Reuter thanking both our guests, John Neuer and Paul Larkin. We certainly appreciate your time today and your insights. This has been very interesting. I want to thank the audience as well for dialing in and for your thoughtful questions. A reminder to our audience to check your emails and monitor the Federal Society website for our next scheduled telephone conference call. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federal Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.